Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
It's the Underpowered Hour. We're off on spring break this week, so we're bringing you a classic episode with none other than Land Rover legend, Mr. Jeremy Hart. We'll be back next week with an all-new episode. Until then, here's the show.
Welcome to the Underpowered Hour. I'm Steve Barris, mild-mannered television executive by day and Land Rover collector by night. You can find out more about our cars and what we're working on at thebarriscollection.com or follow us on Instagram at thebarriscollection. I'm joined, as always, by my good friend, Ike Goss.
Thank you to everyone joining us today. I own and operate Pangolin 4x4 in Springfield, Oregon, where we live and breathe Land Rovers. Check us out online on Facebook, Instagram at Pangolin 4x4. Let's get started.
All right, Ike, we are back again. And just to start off, we ended last episode, which, as I imagine, most of our viewers save up 20, maybe 25 episodes and binge them all over a long sleepless weekend. We stopped when the Camel Trophy truck on Bring a Trailer had about 5 minutes left to go. We considered continuing to record the episode, which would have meant we would record it for another 2 hours because it just kept going. Holy moly, did that thing keep going. And I believe your estimate was in the 70,000 range. Mine was in the 80,000 range. We were off by almost a factor of half.
Oh, yeah.
That thing really ran. It really went.
Tremendous bidding on that Discovery. Nothing like a 30-year-old SUV to really bring out the bidders.
Yeah, it's true. It's I don't know. And now I've heard, of course, this has sort of stoked the fires of those folks who own Camel Trophy vehicles. I think there may be a little rash of sales in chatting with our good friends over at Robotalk, over Ivan and Dan. I think next time, because I think everybody in the Land Rovering world was watching this auction at the same time, next time we're going to do a live stream. We're going to do a play-by-play stream like it was Olympic tennis.
Like a 5-hour marathon.
That's exactly right. We're all going to get on an Instagram Live and we're going to ABC sports that
I'm
sucker.
I'm going to have to practice my auctioneering voice.
Oh, it's going to be great. I think the next one that someone wants to sell, I think they should sell through the podcast here. Much wider distribution, much I think more active audience.
It's a great idea.
Bring a trigger.
It's a great idea.
And it's what everybody's doing.
And you could bid.
And I could.
You could bid. You need another Camel Trophy Discovery.
Yeah, I need another Camel Trophy Discovery. Like I need to get punched in the face. That's
a lot.
Like very punchable guy. Is this the top selling Camel Trophy truck ever? We've yet to see a Defender Camel Trophy car come across the block. I think that will be very interesting to see. If one of those comes up in the future, that could be even more. I mean, are we going to get a $250,000 Camel Trophy truck? Does that mean that it has sort of hit the space of legitimate motorsport collecting. I don't know. I guess we'll just have to see.
I mean, I guess that's a moving target, right? What do you consider as a legitimate, you know?
Yeah.
And legitimate motorsport.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. That's a question I need somebody to answer who's been on the Camel Trophy. How legitimate is the competition? Like, do they keep score? What do? They vote on the winner? Like, it's not a point-to-point race, right?
Like, you
there are special are stages on some of them?
You're in luck because today, in just a short few moments.
Brief moments away,
our guest is Mr. Jeremy Hart.
What?
Legendary journalist.
How did we get him? How did we get him?
It was, we have kidnapped members of his family. No, has no idea. No, he thinks this is an episode of Top Gear. And so so please no one mention it until the episode is
come
out. Don't tell him. But of course, Jeremy has been on many, if not most, of the Camel Trophies, including the one with boats, which is I'm sure a fun conversation, as well as any number of amazing cross country, across many different country expeditions and rallies and things. So we'll talk to him about that coming up in just a moment. But before that, I wanted to just quickly touch on, because this is a personal argument that is happening in my family, as well as I think of many families. And there was an article that I read this week about the Land Rover Defender, the new Land Rover Defender, the McGovern, being better as the 90 than it is as the 110, that the one you should be buying is the Defender 90. Of course, you can't buy any of them because they're sold out everywhere. And especially the 90. The 90 is even more sold out. But that, imagine a world where you could buy them, that you should be buying the 90. So much so, in fact, that there was a design award a couple of weeks ago that awarded the Defender 90 the top designed car in some made-up contest of some sort of thing. But it seems to be that people are really keying in on the car, even though it's missing two doors. What do you think?
I have thought this from the beginning, from when we saw them unveiled in Palm Springs, that the 90 was a better looking vehicle. And, you know, I think it has to do with the proportions, you know, in my personal opinion. You know, the 90 has a short overhang, you know, traditionally. Mm-hmm. And that's still true of the new 90, but it is not I mean, it is also true of the 110. So the 110 doesn't look like, you know, proportionally the traditional 110 vehicle in profile, right? Like in an elevation. So, you had that space over the rear wheel in a 110, which we kind of talked about when we talked about the 130. You know, the 130 does have that overhang. And so proportionally, it looks more like a traditional Defender product. I think the 90, you know, retains that look, and it doesn't have the signature panel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just a few elements make it look more traditional Defender. Like, it would be easier to style it in a retro way that would make it look like an older Defender. So I think people are responding to that.
I've seen some folks who have gone through and done a sort of, you know, accessorized, retroized, if you will, Defender 90. And it does look pretty good, I have to say. I've seen one with the black roof, especially the wheel flares, the fender arches, the plastic fender arches, just give it that, you know, sort of hint of classic Defender that I almost wonder if it wasn't a mistake to not include those as the standard and have a fender arch remove as an option.
Oh yeah.
You know, because they do really, I mean, it's funny how something's just little like that, right? Really sets the car in a different stance. It gives the side of the car a much different look. And much like the Series 3 versus the Land Rover 90, rather, I guess, and the Defender, the addition of those wheel arches onto the Defender is kind of standard. And at one point, they just, you know, they stopped not having the wheel arches, right? They were just painted body color, but they've always sort of had them. That's a big differentiator between those cars. I think that's one of those elements that, especially on the white car with the black fender arches, that starts to really look, like my, if I have a white Defender 90, that starts to really kind of give you the impression that these two cars sort of are somewhat related.
Yeah, I think for me, it's the blue with the white mm-hmm. roof and yep. The black fender arches that some people have done, that really sets off that traditional look for me. Yep. The steel wheels, for what they got too many holes. And we talked about
holes. We've been down this road,
holes.
Of
they got too many they holes, got like yeah. 150 holes in them.
Yeah,
they got and so holes. I don't know. That doesn't do it for me.
No. Well, I do believe the Jamie Oliver butter churn option will be available as a dealer installed option later on this year for the Defenders. So that's a no holes there because the butter would get out. So
that's true. That's true. Yeah. They can't do like, a normal trailer hitch. They have to mm-hmm. use that like phallic hitch that they, but they have a butter churn option,
but they got the butter churn option. Yeah. They can't, but you can tow with a Skoda 8,000 pounds with that hitch.
8,000 pound hitch, like dongus hitch on the back of your Defender. It's
but not 1 pound more.
No.
Not 1 pound more.
No.
No. No. No. No. Certainly not. Yeah. I, you know, it's funny that you say the blue with the white roof because, like, I'm really torn. Do I have a black with a white, well, black roof with a white body to sort of match the Defender 90 that I have? Or do I get the white roof with the blue? Because, you know, my original Stage One, my first ever Land Rover, was that color combination.
Mm hmm.
And so it's super nostalgic. I love that blue with white. It's the most Land Rovery combo.
It's great.
You know, I also kind of like the sort of that sort of pastel green color that they have is kind of neat. They have some neat colors, and they tend to just look better on the 90. Like, it's interesting. Oh, and yeah. I don't know if it's because the glass sort of separates the roof from the body in a little bit more elegant way than the 110. But yeah, I don't know. And I hear. It's not, I haven't tried it. I'm going to have to go. Maybe I'll go down to one of our local dealers and try this out. Maybe I'll take a video and I'll put it on Instagram. Trying to get into the back of the 90. I don't know how difficult that is. Of course, we only have one, you know, little 7-year-old, and she's, you know, like a spider monkey. So I don't think would be difficult for her to get back there. But, like, you know, if we had to throw Linus in the back of that thing, you know, is it possible? Can a full size adult actually get into the back of the 90? Does the seat come far enough out of the way? You know, and I guess if you're doing that every day and, like, you're, you know, you have a family of four, you know, with two teenagers or something, the 90 may not be practical because, you know, flipping the seats up constantly to get people in the back, that probably doesn't make sense. But at the same time, I don't know. I think it's kind of a neat vehicle. Now, I do know there's absolutely no cargo space behind those rear seats when you have the rear seats flipped up in the 90, just like the modern 90, you know, just like my 90, there's no, if you had that bench seat in, which I don't, but if you had that bench seat in, there's no cargo space at all with the seat down. So I don't know.
You know, I think that the wheelbase really helps that proportion as well. Right. You know, it's a 100-inch yeah. wheelbase for those of yeah. you that don't know on the Defender 90, which makes all kinds of sense. And yeah. then the 110 is actually like 120-ish, yeah. something like yeah. that. So that, I think, helps with the proportion because the car's wider, the car's yeah. taller, the car's bigger in most dimensions. And so yeah. when you couple that with the, you know, shorter wheelbase of the 90/100,
yeah.
I think it looks more traditional. Now, let's go back to the marital discord that you're experiencing.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah,
what is your position?
Well, I'm fairly staunchly 90 because of all of the things we've just talked about. Mm-hmm. And I think Liza, my wife, she's much more 110 because of practicality, you know, because of getting, you know, Cooper, our daughter, in and out of the back, because of loading up gear to go camping, because of all of these things, which makes total sense, to be fair. And unfortunately, the P400E, which will come to the United States at some point in the future next year, the P400E it does not, unfortunately, come in the 90-inch wheelbase. It only comes in the 110. So you can't get the hybrid car in the 110 or in the 90. And so, you know, the question is, well, then I don't know, because we really did want the plug-in hybrid. That's trying to be as environmentally responsible as possible with a fleet of old diesel and gas burning Land Rovers. You know, the new one should, you know, be a little bit more fuel efficient, but you can't get it in the 90, which is kind of a bummer, because I think that's where you'd want that car.
You think so? Yeah. You know, usually when you talk about something that is more sustainable, you think about something that's maybe a little smaller, maybe a little lighter, maybe a little more efficient. And if you can't get those features in the smaller version, I think that's a missed opportunity personally.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. All right. Well, we'll have to see what happens in the future, what car I end up buying, if any at all. Of course, the next car up is not a Land Rover. It's a Ford Lightning. So we'll have to see. We'll have to. Oh, I know. Don't tell anybody. Don't tell anybody. But again, huge deal, huge get. Please don't tell him that this isn't Top Gear. But coming up right now, we're about to start up the interview machine, fill it full of maple syrup, which was just coincidentally extra maple syrup had to be released from the Canadian Reserve.
Strategic Reserve.
The Strategic Reserve. It's a sign of the end of days. You know, when we tap into the Strategic Reserve, of maple syrup, it is one of the signs of the apocalypse. So, at any rate, let's gas her up with the finest grade A maple, and let's get Jeremy dialed in. All right, so we are here, finally, hugely anticipated on Ike and I's part. Ever since we bumped into each other at Bob Ives' farm in the middle of, if I had to describe it to you, and my life depended on it, England. I couldn't. There's no way I could draw a map to Bob Ives' place. It's by some
third
hedges.
You
know, sort of south of England, south of London, by some hedges. The incomparable Jeremy Hart, journalist, adventurer, collector of machetes, all around amazing gentleman. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us, Jeremy, this morning, afternoon, evening, and such a thrill to have you.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. It was great to meet you guys in England. And yeah, he was the third hedge on the left, and that's about accurate.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, now, man, what a we finally just happened to drive by a driveway and like, oh, there's a bunch of camel trophy trucks down there. Quickly turn left, and didn't manage to get our Skoda high centered on the farm. So that was personal best Skoda off road trip.
You did almost run over that fellow who was in a sleeping bag in the middle of the parking area.
Yeah, our good friend from the Land Rover photo album just went ahead and just bivy bagged under his discovery there in the parking lot.
He was canoodling with a drone, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, that's true.
Wouldn't have been Bear Grylls. He probably would have been in a hotel.
Yeah, that's right. There was no good hotel.
Allegedly.
Allegedly, that's right. There's nobody's ever panned to the left or right of any one of those shots.
I don't understand how those people on the production can take that seriously. Like, he's eating a bat, and like the production crew is just sitting there eating Luna bars. Like,
yeah, no, it's good. Bat flavored Luna
bars. Bat flavored.
So it's all right. It's all in. So
yeah, look at the ingredients. There's probably a bit of bat.
There's a little bit of bat in there. There's a little bit of bat in every.
That's
Luna
why
bar.
We're that's in this pandemic so. Right now.
It's a fucking Luna bar. That's exactly right. So, Jeremy, we ask everybody a few questions just to kick things up, just to warm things up, if you will. So the first question we always start with, because I think Ike and I, again, are trying to figure it out for ourselves, this experiment in explaining why it is that we do this. But why, with all of the brands in all of the world, is it that you are a fan of the Land Rover?
That's a very good question. I didn't grow up with them. We didn't have Land Rovers in the family, but when I started out as a journalist, I saw an advertisement for Camel Trophy and thought, well, that looked fun. So found the name of the PR and said, are you taking any journalists? He said, yeah, two. And I said, excellent. How do I get on? He said, well, if you can find enough outlets to take a story on Camel Trophy. This was 86.
Right.
And at the time, I was about 21. And so found about four or five outlets to take a story on it and got invited. That was my first relationship with a Land Rover was Camel Trophy. So
your first time in a Land Rover was in a Camel Trophy Land Rover.
First time in one, because we did training and everything else. But yeah, that was my first trip in a Land Rover was in a Camel Trophy. Yeah, no, that's in at the deep end for sure.
As I think most people's first trip is down to the shops or something, you know, and certainly here, I think most people's are back and forth to the Costco. Wow, that is quite an intro. So given that, then what is, you know, of all Land Rovers, doesn't have to be necessarily something that you currently have or have had, but what is your favorite Land Rover?
I'm lucky. I've had a few. Always fancied a Series 1, but you know what? It's nice idea and all the rest of it. But having been in a Series 1, it's if Costco is really nearby and the road is very smooth, that's great. But not for anything else. I had a 97 NAS. I had a 4-liter NAS in the UK, which was very, very, very unusual.
Yes.
Anyone knows they were all automatics in 97.
Yep.
Mine was slightly different. Your friend of mine, Phil at Dunsfold, dropped a Wolf, the military spec Defender transfer box into it.
Okay.
Because for some reason, Americans like driving around at 1,200 RPM at 90 miles an hour.
Yes, absolutely.
And in the UK, our roads would, you know, need a little bit more get up and go.
Yeah.
So the transfer box enabled it to accelerate a little quicker, and I would regularly take Porsche 911s to 30 off the line, and with a straight through exhaust as well.
Oh, fantastic! Oh, that sounds like a great car. Yeah, I drove my NAS Defender here this morning, and it is nothing. No one would ever accuse you of being quick off the line.
I sold my NAS Defender because I prefer driving to Costco. Actually, I don't go to Costco in my Series 1 because I just like Series 1s. But
yeah. Yeah, wow. I was driving my Series 1 this weekend. You know, it is it is absolutely an acquired taste. If it was your only car like it is Ike's, you know, you have to have a certain, you know, disposition, a certain Sasquatchy and disposition that Ike really embodies. And then
I could do Sasquatch, but I thought you know, to be on Her Majesty's YouTube, you know, not only give the top a buff, but also go around the chin. Yeah, but I feel very inadequate up against you guys.
Well, yeah,
I certainly wouldn't make the ZZ Top audition.
We were accused of that very multiple times in the UK.
It's funny. I think in the UK, the only people that anybody has ever seen there with truly long beards, with wizard beards, are ZZ Top. So I appreciate that. Good guys on ZZ Top. Yeah, they're good American legends. Rusty, unfortunately, just passed away. Just a couple weeks ago, that's very sad.
Rest in peace.
So at the end of the day, you see the NAS 97 NAS. Is that is that the only Land Rover you've ever owned? What other ones have you had?
No, I've had quite a few. I sold that stupidly. Somebody made me a big offer, and I went with the dollars or the pounds, and wish I hadn't. So I'm in the market for another one. If anyone knows one in the UK, get in touch.
Phil has one.
Phil has also, he has 97 Freelanders, if you're interested.
Yes.
I think you could kind of pick through there and grab
them. Do I have to? When they started putting Freelander on Camel Trophy, you know you were in trouble.
Right.
You know,
I talked to someone yesterday. We were chatting. Will Hendrick, who's an importer here in the United States, a good friend of the show. We were talking about the one Camel Trophy Freelander in the United States. And is that a thing? Is that a novelty to have that? It's certainly a novelty, but is it a collectible thing? Does it run?
What about the Camel Trophy Honda CR-V?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, the Camel Trophy Edition Honda CR-V.
Yeah, but at least the Honda CR-V was a bit more reliable.
Oh, what?
I think that's fair to say. But I did the last one. I did the 2000 Camel Trophy in the boats.
Yeah.
I like a boat.
Yeah.
It turns out it was a lesson from a guy that had been arrested for drug smuggling in Miami, but I did a powerboat school in Florida. Yeah. And 90 miles an hour in a powerboat. That was true Don Johnson style. So yeah, I like a boat. So Camel Trophy with boats was fine, just not the vehicles.
Well, that's a good place to start, maybe, Jeremy, in the amazing saga of you and the Camel Trophy, nearly 20-year history with the Camel Trophy. Let's start backwards. Let's start with the boat. So an interesting place, certainly, to end the legacy of Camel Trophy, but I have to say, and Ike knows this well, everybody who listens to them knows this well, I covet one of those Camel Trophy boats above all things, because they're just
ribbed
the
for
the
your
most
pleasure.
Oh, they certainly are. So what was that event like? Not a lot of people,
wet.
Certainly, one would imagine so. So
yeah,
it was
always wet.
Yeah. And so what, like, similar to the Camel Trophy in that, like, special stages and the video and things on the 2000 event is not plentiful. It's hard to get a really good sense of the event. So from firsthand, what was your impression of it?
Well, I think the most amazing bit of it, and that it's very hard to get across on video, is the fact that it ran between Tonga, Fiji, and Samoa.
Yeah.
Look at a map and, you know, use your finger or a pencil or whatever, and you try and work out the distances between those places and
right.
put it somewhere familiar, whether it's, you know, the UK or everywhere is bigger than the UK or the US. It's a big
right.
old distance. So some of the transits you did between those places in themselves were mammoth. So not
right.
to be underestimated as an achievement. Yes, they did mm-hmm. the competitive elements of it, and the boats were heavily involved. That's why they had those huge cages on them. If you've seen pictures of the Camel Trophy boats, they carried a lot of stuff. And those were very weak, actually. That was that wasn't a great design, and they needed bolstering. Not for the first time. That happened in 87. We had to strengthen the roof racks. But it was a lot. They were carrying a lot of stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Whatever it was, paddle boards, kayaks, geez,
all kinds of
everything.
Shit. Yeah, yeah.
But it was good to be the final one because it was different.
Mm-hmm.
I was very fortunate. I did 86, 87, 88. So that was Australia, Madagascar, Sulawesi, which is in Indonesia. And then I thought, right, well, I've probably done this now for a bit. So went away for a few years, let Bob and Joe Ives. Sadly, I wasn't there when they won in 89.
Yeah.
And then came back in 94, 95, which was Central America and the one across South America as well.
Yeah.
But by then, it had started to soften up. And I think post 95, no disrespect to anybody that was on it, because to get into Camel Trophy, you are a legend.
Yes. But huge achievement.
The format by then had become very soft.
Mm-hmm.
It had started to pander to things that the original ones hadn't done. But the world had changed. If we think we live in a politically correct world now, the difference between, you know, even the mid-80s ones and the mid-90s ones was hugely different. So to finish with 2000 in the boats was great, because you couldn't compare it to anything else. You couldn't go, well, this is better than, you know, the Trans Amazon in 79 done in Jeeps, or Borneo in whatever it was, 84, which was so hardcore they had to helicopter the cars out, you know, all that kind of stuff. So
was it better than the Freelander and Kayak event? I don't remember what year that was.
Then the thing is.
I
love most Land Rovers, as you can probably tell, but Freelander is not high on my list. And, you know, it did well for the company and they made some money out of it. But, you know, and now, let's face it, you look at most, you know, crossovers or soft SUVs or whatever, you know, it was a leader. It was a pathfinder, if you want to call it. And, you know, it was not that bad off-road. By the time they finished the Freelander, it was actually, it was pretty capable. The early ones, though, were more car than...
Getting to the place where you would drive off a road is really where they succumbed, you know, to road.
Maybe they would be okay off-road, but it was just driving a car normally. Yeah, they weren't
they
great
struggled.
At that.
Well, here in the U.S., we only got the V6 versions, which in retrospect are not well thought of. And so there's...
I
would say in the whole United States, there's probably like 100 Freelanders on the road still running and driving. Like,
yeah, maybe.
They sold a lot of them, but...
It might be eight.
I'm being generous because I never see them.
Great. Yeah, it's not great. You see them every once in a while, but never running. Never running. I see them for sale. They come up every once in a while. Never running. I've never found one that you could drive away.
Now, this is a little controversial.
There's a challenge.
Sorry, go ahead.
There's a challenge. Make one run.
There's a challenge. We'll do that. We're going to do that. We're going to give Ike two days and a Freelander.
I couldn't do it.
And you need to, drive out of the woods.
No, or couldn't do it.
Leave you in the woods with a Freelander.
It's true. What now, controversially, some people, you know, compare the styling of the Freelander to the new Defender because it has that central, you know, grill area that, protrudes a lot more maybe than the traditional Defender, which is quite flat at the front. You know, what do you think of that?
Well, I've got a new Defender, and I've never once looked at it and got, oh my God, someone's going to think I'm driving a Freelander.
Oh, no, now you're going to know.
Somebody compared it. What was there's a Ford that you guys had. We never had it. It looked like an elongated kind of mini.
Yeah, Flex. I think it's the Ford Flex that people compare it. Yeah.
In Funkmaster Flex.
True.
It is exactly that. Yeah, I believe he designed it, in fact.
I think I've had the pleasure of going to Funkmaster Flex's garage in LA, New York.
Yeah.
And he was a lovely man. Lovely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So anyway, new Defender, Freelander, I think that's harsh. I gave up a 2015 Defender for one of the new ones after seeing Bob Ives, legend, Camel Trophy, winner from 89, post a picture of him in one of the new Defenders. And I messaged him. I said, oh, is that some kind of freebie from Land Rover? And he went, no, I bought it. I went, and ... And he goes, it's awesome. So as of August 2020, I am the proud owner, no freebies, of a full drug dealer spec black on black.
We've seen it. We were there.
I have. I've seen it. It is murdered out. It's murdered all the way
out. Totally murdered.
Well done. Yeah, I've put a few tricks on it. It's got a front runner roof rack and Melville and Moon seat covers, which are all South African stuff. Really good kit. Good kit.
Looks amazing.
So,
did Funkmaster Flex consult on the accessories package that had on your? It seems as though he may.
Mine. And if there wasn't any mud on it, I forgot to put some on. But but mine is actually properly capable of going. Properly capable of going stuff.
We started this episode with a conversation about the new Defender, and my wife and I are currently in conversation about do we have a 90 or a 110, and all of the marital dispute that goes into that. Because I sort
Who's
of fancy
winning?
90. You know, well, does anybody really win in that? But
I'm going to tell you a story just quickly. Sorry to interrupt. Is that we were on a holiday. We were on vacation in the Alps, and there happened to be close to the hotel we were staying a classic car auction.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife goes, "You knew that was happening, didn't you?" Just knew. And I went, "No, honestly, I had no idea that it was going." And this was probably 18 years ago, and one of my all-time dream cars is a Lancia Stratos.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And they had one for sale. Was £70,000, so about $100,000. And I was like, well, I don't have that, but for a Lancia Stratos, maybe I could borrow it or whatever. Anyway, unfortunately, my son, who was small at the time, then went and told my wife, who then came to... Do we really need a Lancia Stratos? They are now worth about £500,000. And so that is the one and only time that we've ever worked together on the family car buying.
Go
for the 110. The 90, unless you have no friends, which I doubt.
The 90s is small. Yeah, I like the idea of not being able to take anybody in my car with me, and I can just kind of go off by myself. And it probably, honestly, at the end of the day, will be a 110, and that's because of the P400E here in the United States. The hybrid is only available. The plug-in hybrid is only available in the 110. And that's really something that we are striving, as I have a fleet of diesel and gas burning cars. It's striving to be slightly more environmentally responsible, and so that may just kick it at the end of the day, anyways. Good to know that you're a fan, and certainly and Bob Ives is coming up on the show here soon. We'll have to ask him about his fondness for the new Defender as well. I think initially design wise and whatever, it kind of got a bit of a bad rap. I've actually always kind of liked the way that it looks, Yeah, because you have a black one, you don't have the signature panel on the side of the car that that sort of sticks out awkwardly. It's black with the rest of the car.
What was Geraldine thinking designing that? He was on another planet. You know, yeah. There we go. Maybe it was on the same folder as the back of the current Discovery. I don't know.
It could have been. That's right. Exactly.
I like to think that there was like a design, you know, that he was working with, and he just like forgot and like left a document over, like open on his computer. And like took a screenshot of it, and then he had a meeting, and then he was like, "Oh yeah, I meant to do that," because it just looks like a sheet of paper with a little Land Rover logo stuck to the side of the car. It looks like the dealer's window sticker is like permanently attached to the car.
Yeah. One thing that Ike has taken to do is signing the signature panel on cars. So if he's in the parking lot of a, you know, if your Defender is parked up somewhere near Eugene, Oregon, you may get an Ike Goss signature across that panel.
It's true.
Yeah. Makes the car
if you're lucky.
Significantly less valuable.
Check it's not there now because you walk right past mine. Make sure you didn't sign it.
I carry a paper.
That's
pen.
True.
It's true.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it'll make the car significantly less valuable to have that signature on there. It's significantly less valuable.
The price of used cars has gone through the roof. Mine is worth £15,000, so it's about $20,000 more today with 10,000 miles on the clock than it was a year ago.
Right, when you bought it new, yeah. It's the same here. It is insane. We cleared out some new cars because it was sort of didn't make any sense to keep them in the garage where we weren't using them. You know, again, they were worth more than we paid for them. So why would, why keep them around? No, it is amazing. The whole world, it's happening sort of to the whole world. We were just talking, I don't know if you saw, Jeremy, here on there's a an auction website here in the United States called Bring a Trailer, and a Camel Trophy car from what year was it? I cannot remember now off the top of my head.
92.
Anyways, it would have been 92 because it was a two door. The winning car from that year, the Discovery, sold for $140,000 United States dollars just last week on that website. So, just I think the market in general for cars, be them used, you know, be them daily drivers or collectible cars, has just exploded here in the last year. I think there's some idle time that people have.
Well, they're just not making cars anymore. Nobody can make cars. So they're just like,
you can't make a new car.
Yeah. Scarce.
You may want to.
That is a bit of a problem.
So, Jeremy, one of the things we wanted to talk about is your mini trips. And many times people, you know, you're lucky if you found somebody who's driven across the United States on a road once. You would be even harder pressed to find somebody who's driven across the United States, you know, fully more than once. And I would say it's nearly impossible to talk to someone who has driven across the United States many times, not using any paved roads. And so let's talk about that a little bit. So come back to it.
Sorry.
No problems. No, we'll talk about it again. You know, let's talk about that a little bit. Let's talk about driving across the United States, not using any roads. And this is, so far as I understand it, but correct me, more or less based on an off-road motorcycle sort of route that was sort of pioneered for motorcycles. And,
let's just wait until all that shit's done.
Yeah, that's gone. Sorry about
that. That's all right.
No.
The joy of working from home. It wasn't even an office call. I do apologize.
No problem. Yeah,
no worries.
We can edit that out. It's no problem.
Yeah, I'll just start it over. So there's no problem. So the task of undertaking an off-road cross country, especially, and this isn't crossed England, which Ike and I have done accidentally by a number of times.
We took a wrong turn and we like crossed three times.
Like, oh shit, we're in Wales. Yeah. You know, or you're in New York and you're like, you get off you stay on the subway one extra stop and you're in friggin' New Jersey. But this is the entire United States where you didn't just stay on the subway too long and end up in New Jersey. You stayed on the subway too long and ended up in California. So what is that like? Talk to me about, first of all, where does that idea come from? And then logistically speaking, how do you plan that route and decide how to, you know, get all that done?
Well, it was an interesting concept because I'm really lucky. I mean, I have been starting in 86 on Trophy in Australia. I've literally been everywhere on every continent in the Land Rover.
Yeah.
except Antarctica, which had to do, unfortunately, in our own day.
I have a plan for you, Jared. Just wait. We'll talk about that after the show.
I'm very fortunate, and I've taken Land Rovers most places on the planet, and I was doing a little bit of research. And yes, I spent a lot of time in the States, and fortunate. The only state I haven't been to is Rhode Island. So I must correct.
Oh, you're not missing anything.
Oh, well, my good friend
Cohog's great.
Mr. Leno has a property there now.
It's so just a state that you drive through on your way to another state.
Well, yeah. I read about these crazy motorcyclists who, over a period of 30 years, had pieced together sections of trail, mountain pass, farmers' fields, you name it, anything that wasn't sealed. Pulled together what they called the Trans-America Trail. Mm-hmm. And at that time, it started in Asheville, which I think is North Carolina.
That's right.
And ran all the way across to your home state, Oregon.
It's true. Mm-hmm.
Tennessee, down into Mississippi, Arkansas, where else did we go? Colorado, very little bit of California, mm-hmm. Utah, you name it. And finished on the Pacific coast in Oregon. So I called the guy that kind of put all this together. I said, do you think you could do it in a vehicle? He goes, well, what do you got? I said, well, probably do it in an LR4 at the time. Mm-hmm. That was, mm-hmm. He goes, I think there's one bit that you might struggle with, but everywhere else, I think you could do it.
Yeah.
So I went to Stuart Shaw, who's the head of communications for Land Rover in the US. Mm-hmm. And I said, what do you reckon? He said, no one's ever completed. A few people have tried it in side-by-sides and, some people have done bits of it, but never the whole thing. And he goes, let's do it. So he put me together with a guy who I've known for a long time, who was in on Camel Trophy in 87 for the American team, Tom Collins, known as TC, who's out of Colorado. So he did the hard work. He did all the map work. And I came up with all the stories, all the color, all the fun stuff, if you like, that we did en route. Because let's face it, a long journey is boring. Until you do the cool stuff.
Right.
So we worked, we had to go with the route that was created. We couldn't suddenly go lots of other places. Mm-hmm. And we ended up in some awesome spots. Clarksdale, Mississippi was one of my favorites. I'm a big music fan.
Yeah.
And it turns out that's the home of Morgan Freeman. And he runs a blues club there. So we got in touch with Mr. Freeman and with his friend, who's the mayor of Clarksdale, happened to be in Clarksdale on the day that Mr. Freeman was there. Then we went and hung out with him, went to his Ground Zero Blues Club. And that was just epic. So it was a month of doing this, a lot of finding great stories. TC did all the map work, and then we just did all this amazing stuff. And Jay Leno ran a film that we made on his YouTube channel. So if you Google Trans-America Trail and Jay Leno, you'll find the documentary that we made. But it was wonderful. And what I loved about it, and I'm ignore the accent, I'm very well traveled all around the US. And the one thing I think most people, even Americans, would say is that a lot of towns end up looking very similar, partly because of the fast food chains and all that kind of stuff. This was like going to America, as I guess it was like before all that, proper small towns. We were welcomed like nothing else, particularly in the South. Maybe they like the British accent. But
they're famous for their Southern hospitality. It's a thing.
It's true.
They were
except to each other.
I think I put on like 20 pounds just being south of the Mason-Dixon line, but it was a great trip and certainly a highlight of my career.
That's amazing. Yeah. Well, and I think it's one of those things where, to the best of my knowledge, there are parts of that trail now that are paved or are, no longer. It's every day it gets a little bit more difficult to be truly off-road entirely across
the United States.
Yeah, to be able to do that without hitting a stretch of pavement. So pretty pretty amazing thing, you know, sort of, you know, in the same way that you could never do an Oxbridge. Oxbridge.
There is a thing called Oxbridge. Anyone that went to Oxford or Cambridge, it's known as Oxbridge.
So it's the Oxbridge, yeah. You could never do an expedition like that again because of the countries involved, and some of them are just completely impassable now for political reasons or whatever. It's sort of, you know, unfortunately, you know, the frontier lands of North America, this is sort of similar thing is happening where there's large stretches now where, you know, you can't really do that anymore. Either the land's private or roads have been paved or whatever. So that's, yeah.
I have a habit of going to countries which soon after then close or have civil wars. So,
Interesting. So it's your fault.
I was going to say.
I think Syria had its own problems, but after it became no go. So
some of those may stretch back as far as biblical times, but others it's impossible to entirely rule out the fact that you may have incited.
I'm old, but not that old.
So another casual interest, and then we'll sort of dive a little deeper into the journalism aspect. But this is just something that I'm interested in talking to you about: your replica of an 1881 electric trike. I guess sort of a precursor to a car. Certainly was earlier than that, but is an electric bike. So you've replicated this. What gave you the idea to replicate an 1881 electric trike?
Well, a bit like you were saying, you know, at one point I had three vehicles in my driveway with V8s in, and I guess, you know, I'll always love things that burn fuel and make a good noise, but one way or the other, we've got to go green at some point. Mm-hmm. And more recently, my life has been spent coming up with and executing things like the expedition across America, but also I hate to use the word stunt because anyone that's worked in, you know, TV or films would think that's a fake thing. But all the ones that I've come up with, we've done for real. So, for instance, we put a Jaguar on a high wire over the River Thames, which was pretty amazing. We put a Subaru down a bobsled run in San Moritz with Subaru USA, great bunch of guys. And these kinds of things we're doing pretty regularly at the moment, and there's very few people doing stuff like them. And I was researching a possible idea with electric vehicles and just happened across the fact, and this was February this year, across the fact that the first ever rechargeable electric vehicle was a tricycle made in Coventry, of all places, the home of Jaguar. But then modified by a Frenchman who put his own rechargeable battery and motor onto it and ran it down the streets of Paris in April 1881. So I was going,
wow.
That's in that 140th anniversary is in 8 weeks' time.
Yeah.
So I love the internet. Found a guy in Yorkshire in the north of England, which if you were going to Wales and ended up in Yorkshire, you got lost. And he
We've definitely done at some point. Oh, okay. I guarantee you. Yeah, that's definitely.
Well, next time you get lost in Yorkshire, go see this guy. He's called Christian Richards, and he builds replica penny farthings, all sorts of Victorian bicycle-y type stuff.
Yeah. We would call that a hipster here in the US.
Yeah. And yes, but his are not made out of, anyway.
Yeah.
I called him. I said, could you build a replica of this Victorian tricycle and stick an electric motor on it in 7 weeks' time?
Right.
And he went, yeah, sure. So we got some funding from an electric van manufacturer called Maxus. And away we went. So he built it. We filmed it. And then even in the middle of lockdown, because you could still take transport between the UK and France, even though people couldn't go between the UK and France, we put this electric tricycle in a Maxus van, got it driven over to Paris, and on the 140th anniversary, rode it down the street in Paris where this guy, Gustave Trouvé, who had done the original one, did so. So that was it, really. It was, you know, it wasn't a big mega budget thing. It was just like, you know what? It's cool. and we're going to do it. And I'm really pleased. And somebody has now bought it from me. I've sold it on, and I hope it's gone to a good home. But that was so a lot of fun.
Well, and I think that you bringing back or reminding us that electric vehicles have been a part of our, you know, civilization, our culture since the inception of the vehicle, steam, electricity, things like this had been power plants far before the internal combustion engine. And that's actually a fairly recent thing. And that, you know, the idea that, well, it can, if it's a car, it can only burn, you know, gasoline or diesel, that's actually not even remotely correct. In fact, they were alternate fuels far before then. And speaking of steam power, what a great segue, almost as if I had planned it, to your good friend, Mr. Jay Leno, and a friend of the Los Angeles car community, to say the least. We bumped into each other at the Peterson's Heritage Drive rally over a few weekends ago. And my daughter, has no idea who Jay Leno is, obviously, but had a great conversation with him about her little electric power wheels Land Rover. Jay was very nice and very, very engaged, and so she said she'd give him a ride if he ever wanted to come up. So I would pay almost anything to see that happen. That seems fun. Try to get Jay into that tiny little car would be fantastic, but I'm sure he would give it a go if he could. But so you write an ongoing article that is always fabulous and insightful and interesting and a good take from both your perspectives on whatever it is that you happen to be talking about that given month. So where did that partnership come from? Where did that, sort of friendship start? Why do the monthly article with Jay?
Well, part of my very long sort of background is that I was a writer for Car magazine in London for a long time. And the editor, this is when Jay was, you know, on the Tonight Show every night. And they said, there's this guy in America, Jay somebody, who's apparently got a big car collection. You go to America a lot. Have you ever heard of him? I went, yeah. I said, well, I'll see if I can get hold. So I got hold of a number for the production office at the Tonight Show and got the lovely Helga, who's Jay's long-serving assistant. Who is from Austria originally. It sounds a little bit like a female Arnold Schwarzenegger sort of. And she's a gatekeeper, absolutely lovely lady. And she goes, so who are you? I said, my name's Jeremy. I'm calling from Car magazine in London. And she goes, and I could hear her just having a conversation off phone. And it was clearly to Jay. And she goes, Mr. Leno will talk to you now. So I went straight through to him and he said, you write this car? I went, yeah. He said, oh, what do you want to do? So I said, well, I'd like to come see you and meet you and write about your cars. So that was it. And that was probably 20 years ago. So that was it. And ever since then,
seems straightforward.
We've become good friends. We've done lots of travels together, you know, taking him to Japan with Nissan and Toyota, getting him to travel around Japan on the bullet train.
Yeah.
That was a lot of fun. He came over to Europe, you know, he went on Top Gear. He was the star in the reasonably priced car on Top Gear. So we've had lots of fun together. And Octane, classic car magazine out of the UK, within literally the first month or two of it being a thing, said, do you think Jay would do a column? And at that point, Rowan Atkinson, best known as Mr. Bean, big car collector. Nick Mason, drummer with Pink Floyd, another big car collector, they all had columns. So Jay said, yeah, sure, that'd be great. And whatever we are now, 18 years on, we're still doing it. So I don't write it.
Right.
You know, basically what started with, what do you want in this one? And I would throw ideas in and he'd throw ideas in. And, it's Jay's column, so it was his final decision. So yes, it's a collaboration, but what you're reading and hearing is what Jay says, you know. So I'm a part of it, but it's Jay's column, and it's been an absolute pleasure to do it for so long. It must be one of the longest running columns of any kind, I would have thought. in the world.
That's cool.
Oh, great. And Octet is such a cool magazine too. Like great, really interesting perspective and some, you know, some different kind of things that, yeah, American car magazines tend to be a little formulaic and tend to be driven, I think, a little bit more from the manufacturer's perspective than maybe the enthusiast or the, just the casual reader may. Whereas British car magazines don't sort of, I don't think are quite as beholden to, you know, car manufacturers and the advertising that comes from those manufacturers, as they are here in the States. So I do really enjoy reading those. And because,
I wrote for Top Gear for a while, and that has to be the only car magazine that would allow a writer to write about porn stars in their cars.
That's right.
That was a moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, Top Gear, you know, now has again sort of changed a little bit, right? And that it's a little different than it was. But yeah, man, there was a heyday for both the magazine and the television show that was out of control. We talked a little bit about the porn star driving school. Let's talk about that story quickly. So as I understand it, that was not the original plan.
No, I was going to teach Johnny Rotten from the Sex Pistols, well-known punk band from the late 70s, how to drive. Johnny's a big car fan, lives in LA, but for whatever reason had never learned to drive, never got a driving license.
Right.
So a friend of a friend knows him, and the short story is that I got Aston Martin to come up with a DB9 at the time for the car in which he was going to learn to drive. And Top Gear, when you're learning to drive in the UK, you have to have an L plate on your car. And normally it's red and white. But if anyone's ever seen the cover of I can't say the B word probably.
Yeah.
That album, it looks a bit like that. So we had that all made up, turned up in LA. And unfortunately, Mr. Rotten decided at that moment that he didn't actually want to do this. So
quick interjection. Why does every scooter in the UK have an L plate? Everyone.
Every scooter in central London had an L on it. Every motorcycle as well had an L on it.
Because I think, why would you want a scooter any time after you just learned how to ride
a scooter? Oh,
it's a good idea.
Because girls like scooters. That's why.
Girls like scooters.
Do they?
They do.
Well, maybe that's where I went wrong. Yes.
Oh, different
anyway,
culturally.
Continue. I was
very short version of the story is that a good friend of mine, Bill Nation, runs Pro Italia motorcycle dealership in LA. Yep. And I just saw Bill
last week. He's doing very well indeed. Yeah. And his son is working for Rivian, which is a real departure from.
Yeah, the ones who copied our Transamerica Trail thing.
Yeah,
they did that recently. Although, to give them their due, you can now do it from the East Coast. So they did a little bit. We didn't.
Yeah.
But we commiserated because he'd had a deal fall through for a motorcycle with an adult-orientated movie star. So I said, well, a car, you know, porn stars into their cars and bikes. He said, yeah, absolutely. I said, well, this guy owes you a favor now, doesn't he? And he goes, yeah. I said, well, how about he and a select friend of his come and be in our story about porn stars in their cars. So that's what we did with the Aston Martin.
Yep.
And the story ran in Top Gear, and I think the then CEO of Aston was not very pleased about the use of his car.
Not what he envisioned.
Not exactly, but it's a story I won't forget, but good times.
It's a whole new demographic, though. I think that's Aston Martin needs to drop a bit of the stuff. I mean, they make an SUV now, so I think anything goes. You know, there's just you can do anything now, I guess. I don't know if I fancy the Aston Martin.
Yeah, we're doing a really interesting film with Aston Martin at the moment.
Yeah.
Which unfortunately I can't tell you about because this will probably run before we finish doing it. Mm-hmm. But it's one of the old James Bond cars, and when it's out, I'll tell you about it.
Oh, I can't wait. Well, we'll definitely have you in again. So, before we go to the world famous Ike Goss lightning round, hotly anticipated. I just wanted to quickly touch on ink content. And as you sort of briefly mentioned, cars on wires over the Thames and things like that seems to be sort of, if you are so inclined and you want to put together a stunt, but like you said, a stunt that's actually not a stunt, but a real insane thing that someone is doing, you know, is that sort of the idea behind, you know, behind that venture?
Yeah, so I run two agencies kind of under the same umbrella. One is Ink Content, to be found at inkcontent.com, mm-hmm. INC content. And the other one is Timbuktu Content. And Timbuktu is a place I've been to many times when I was doing the TV commentary for the Paris to Dakar rally.
Yeah.
And these things end up at the same place, that we come up with ideas that get lots of media coverage.
Yeah.
And not in a way that a PR, you know, would do ordinarily. So
Right. We've
put a Jaguar on a high wire over the River Thames. We put a Formula E electric race car on the ice cap in Greenland. Mm-hmm. Admittedly, after the plan to run it on an iceberg failed when the iceberg exploded, that was a little unfortunate.
Hard to foresee those.
The Subaru down the Bob Sovan. And what we've been working on at the moment and looking for a willing partner, should anyone be interested, is to prove the unproven that a Formula One car or a car with a lot of downforce could actually drive upside down. We have a solution to that, and we were going to do that in China at the time where this bug turned up and we were all dodging the Wuhan flu.
That's right. And we're already at Omicron. We don't have that many Greek letters left to go. I don't know what happened to everything between Delta and Omicron, but holy moly. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the day job. And we're very grateful to all the partners and brands that we work with to allow us to do these kinds of things. But it's super fun. And it means I don't have to bump up and down in the back of a Land Rover to earn a dollar anymore. But that's the day job.
Now you can just do that for fun.
Absolutely.
That's right. All right. Well, without further ado, I think it always the most anticipated, certainly by Ike, if not by anyone else, portion of the show and my favorite, because I don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
Prepare yourself with a machete. We're ready to go. The world famous, known the planet over, Ike Goss lightning round question. So, Ike, take it away.
Yeah. Well, if you haven't heard of the show before, Jeremy, quick questions and just brief answers, and there'd be a few, so do your best, and here we go. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right, we'll start with some easy ones. Gas or diesel?
Gas.
Ooh. Coils or leaves?
Coils.
Sand glow or bronze green?
Sand glow.
Continent with the best food?
Hate to say it, but Australia.
Oh, interesting. Ooh. They can't do bacon. Anyway, funniest exclamation after a vehicular failure.
Oh, something like that.
pretty traditional. Best way to remove gear oil from your underwear?
Take your underwear off.
Ooh. Doesn't get it out, though.
Who cares?
Perfect. You did great. I love it.
Thank you.
All right, Jeremy. Well, hey, thank you. And like I said, part one of our 29-part series with Jeremy to get even into the top 10% of things that you've done over your career. Absolutely amazing and awe-inspiring. And please come on the show again, will you? Will you come join us at some point again in the future? Maybe
I'd love to, guys. You guys are doing an epic job, and I'm pleased to be part of it.
That's how we like to explain it. Epic. It is an epic amount of nonsense. About a car that very few people care about, but you know, we are the few and the proud, and we really appreciate you joining
us. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
Well, as predicted, Jeremy is nothing if not an absolute wellspring of stories about porn stars.
Phenomenal. A gentleman and a scholar about more than porn stars. Jeremy's great, and what a wealth of expertise and knowledge about overlanding expeditions, crazy vehicle stunts. Really interesting guy.
Yeah, super cool. What a great show. So coming up here in the next couple of weeks, we've got our incredibly good friend and I mean just amazing legendary individual Bob Ives, winner of the 1989 Camel Trophy, along with his brother. He's going to join us. We've got lots of great stuff, lots of great guests coming up. We haven't had a guest in a little while, but it's nice.
This is great. I love it.
I look forward to the lightning round so much that it was nice to have that back. Again, check out the Underpowered Hour shop. Bigly sales there on the Black Friday and Cyber Monday. We still have some stuff left. We're restocking for Christmas, but yeah, head on over there if you want to get somebody, again, someone you're not, you know, super fond of, maybe a general sort of casual acquaintance, you want to grab them something, head on over to the Underpowered Hour shop. Mm-hmm. YouTube episodes, they're up there, they're on the old YouTube, and we're gaining followers on YouTube like it's our job, so we appreciate those of you who have subscribed, and for those of you who just want to know what we look like, you can head on over there.
Trust me, you'll be disappointed.
Yeah, or visit Ike at his home. Either way, it's fine to do any.
Yes, any I live in things. Valencia, California.
In a cave underneath a roller coaster at Magic Mountain. So please come say hello. Well, Ike, as always, it has been a pleasure, and look forward to catching up again next week after I've finished my 1881 electric tricycle replica. So.
I am looking forward to it. All right, Stephen, take care.
The Underpowered Hour is produced by Liza Barris, Ike Goss, and me, Steve Barris. Pavel Svartov composed and performed our theme music. Consider supporting the show on Patreon, and if you already do, thank you. Your support makes the show possible. For even more, check out our Instagram or Facebook.